Time for our weekly visit with our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, available everywhere, is called If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. Colin joins us this afternoon. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
What's up, Richard?
You are a Zulu warrior, a little bug, whatever it is not going to keep you down.
No, it's against the Zulu code to even really much acknowledge sickness. I want to document it on the blog as a record of my life, but unless it's pneumonia, we didn't know each other back then when I had the pneumonia. It was 2016, and I'd given up drinking a few months before. I might have died, and it was the most pain I've ever been in, and my temperature went to 106. I had to go to the hospital twice. I left each time. I didn't want to stay, but I respect the pneumonia. I do not really respect anything else. I don't even know what this is because I don't have any tests. And I intend to be done with it by tomorrow.
Well, if there's a man alive who can do it, that's you. We've got a lot of things to cover. Let's talk about first a very interesting episode of The Twilight Zone from, I think this must have been the last season, Ring-a-Ding Girl.
Yeah, a couple of days after Christmas, and it was the last season. So at the end of 1963. Do you like this episode?
Yeah, I do. It's... I don't know why. I really like time travel, anything with time travel, and I'm a little bit hooked. So I like that aspect of it. I don't think it's certainly not the best. I think it's an Earl Hamner Jr. script, the guy who wrote The Waltons, and they could be a little hokey at times.
I've always thought that this is one of the best episodes, and at the same time, I've always thought it strange that it's not really talked about that much, and certainly not cited as one of the top episodes of the series. It's not singled out as one of the clunkers either, but anytime I've watched it, you mentioned time travel. It's the time travel of a ghost, though.
Mm.
And that's, like, if we think about any ghost story, not any, but a lot of ghost stories, they're time travel stories in a way, right? When you have this ghost from, like, 100 years ago that used to live in this hall, and I think some of the clunkier aspects of this episode are the transitions to make the plot work, where you have to have these visions and you have to see this like floating face in a ring and everything. But you have to admit, it is a moving idea, this notion of this Hollywood starlet out in the West Coast is going to be traveling home, I think it's to Virginia, for this to see her friends and her family and the members of the community that made her journey, her career, all of that possible by encouraging her when she was a little girl and all this stuff. And it happens to be Founder's Day in this town. And it's an altruistic ghost.
Or right.
It's a liminal state because she's not quite ghost yet. While it's a ghost, a would-be ghost on a field trip to do something, to sort of take some hits too, like reputation-wise at first, because in order to do what this character does, to ultimately save the members of the town, she has to act like a prig.
Right.
And I just remember, like, I was at once, it's a great feeling. I was so creeped out, frightened, truly frightened, but stirred and saddened and warmed by the hug she gives her sister, like to say goodbye, because it's one of those hugs where one person knows something and the other person doesn't, but they're about to. So you're sort of like feeling it for both of you, the person with the knowledge. That's good writing. It's moving, and it's not something that you can really point to in other episodes, stories, films, that kind of thing, and say, oh, yeah, this is comparable. It really is that moment, that gesture is a one-off to this episode.
And you mentioned being scared, and when I first saw it as a kid, and I don't think I was too young to have seen it in its original airing, but I think in probably the first wave of reruns, and I remember being scared after it aired because it made you think about things in a way you weren't used to thinking, and that whole concept of her coming back to save people like that was pretty edgy stuff, and you didn't see that on television much.
I think we get, especially now, we get so restrictive with what a ghost story can be. And I say especially now because they're all of, it's this whole subgenre of film, right? The haunting, the possession, and there's the camera, right? The lo-fi sort of security camera capturing like some shadow approaching the baby's crib, that type of thing. That's just a cliche at this point. Ghost stories, I feel, used to be a lot richer, where they didn't have to be for scares, and they didn't have to just be for atmosphere, and sometimes they didn't even have to have ghosts, because we think of all the things that we're haunted by. We're haunted by our memories and our conscience, and that was something certainly that Shakespeare understood the latter. With Macbeth and Banquo, when he shows up at the all-you-can-eat dinner. And so that was something that you'd think with the Twilight Zone, because Twilight Zone does horror, but Twilight Zone doesn't do a lot of ghost stories. Now, there are some, we can name some, and which the one where the character, the Western, the guy goes out to the tombstone, the graveyard, right? He ends up like getting nailed to the ground, and he dies that way.
Yes, yeah.
There. But we can explain that away pretty easily. We can say that was his paranoia, his imagination, his guilt. We can't explain this away. Not only is this a ghost story, most of the town is in on the experience. Because if people haven't seen this, the starlet says, no, I don't want you all to go to Founders Day in this big field and have like your small town jamboree. I want to go to the high school, and I'll like field questions and do a talent show. I'm like this important star, come out. And so when the plane that she's actually on, that we learn later, crashes, I guess this is the kind of coincidence you have to buy into. Like, what are the chances it's going to land in this field where these people would have been, and they're not now because she's gotten them away from there. So everyone has, like, not everyone, but a lot of people end up interacting with her. Like the custodian at the school, like all of these sort of people are in on this, like this young boy. So normally we think of like our ghostly experiences happening in isolation. Like if I was to ask you, have you ever had like a time you were creeped out that you thought there was a presence of something else there? It would have just been you. It wouldn't have been like one time me and Carrie went to the ground round. It wouldn't be like that. So that always stuck out to me too. I found it very creatively liberating. Mm.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's stay with television, and I didn't even know that this existed, a television version of the radio serial Lights Out. Wow, was that something?
Yes, and a lot of those shows did double duty, Gunsmoke, radio and TV, that kind of thing. And some of them went on at the same time, which to me would have been quite strange. But this Lights Out adaptation of M.R. James's story, the tractate Medoff. And it's like many James stories, it's a ghost story involving antiquarians and books and ciphers and this will that's hidden away in this ancient, like Talmudic kind of book. And so the way that Lights Out is, lights out on the budget. They transpose the story from the England of M.R. James to New England. And there's just a vibe that you automatically get when you know something set in New England, even if you're only seeing interiors. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because we don't see, we're not like out in the field, like looking for Harry with Alfred Hitchcock and it's fall and just what you think of as Vermont or anything like lobster pots. We're just inside on these sets. But when we know we're in New England, it's like a secondary assist.
Oh, yeah, and when he's trying to take the train trip to New Hampshire to get a little rest, like, oh, he's getting a little close to me on that train. My goodness.
I like that part, too, because it's not in the M.I. James where he's like, go left, go right for each of these different trains. And he ends up running into this apparition who's like this travel agent in reverse. And the apparition sort of like gives him this body language, like, not the train for you. The other one, that one, another state. And so he needs to go to this other state. He's sort of routed along by the apparition. That is true to the James story. So that he can end up in the company of this woman and her comely daughter. We all know how that's going to go. Who has been cheated, it sounds like, out of her rightful inheritance. So it's a ghost story, yes, but it's also like a mystery. It's kind of a legal whodunit, like the codicil version of an Agatha Christie type of thing, overlaid with the haunting vibes of a M.R. James. And so I find that when the budget is low like that, and you're relying on the actors and the interaction between people, and the sets are what they are, that your imagination just goes to work, because that's more true to life. It's like that Christmas film with Robert Mitchum, Holiday Affair, or Scrooge that I did the book about. They're not like hitting you over the head with like Christmas and splendor and mistletoe and all that stuff, because a lot of times that's just not how that holiday is for people. So we sort of find a way to read our own experiences or project our own experiences or pull our own experiences out of what we're seeing and maybe understand them a bit better. So, yeah, creaky in some ways, but it certainly holds my attention.
And a wonderful appearance by a very, very young Leslie Nielsen in the lead.
Leslie Nielsen was in, it's kind of sad that some people just know him from the sort of like the cartoonish like baseball thing, right? Dancing on the Field, and there's Reggie Jackson, all that stuff. But he was in a lot of different TV shows. What's the one where he's like the skin diver, too? Like, he was in so many different things as this jobbing actor. And so it's fun for people who like to, like, catch a glimpse of someone. But you wouldn't think, like, I don't know. I think people regard him almost as, like, this action hero type of person or this sort of, like, satirical comedic guy. But he plays this straight here as a guy, a young man, who is even, like, taking a toll on his body, this experience that so he's essentially going away for, like, his health. That's sort of like why he's out of, you wouldn't think just being some librarian, kind of like that's all he is. I mean, not all he is, but you wouldn't think like it's rife with danger could be so disastrous, potentially disastrous, but he's good in this too. I mean, everything. It's not like you're going to have 17 actors in it as well. It's almost like a play that was filmed, and what survives is the kinescope. Kinescopes themselves are kind of ghastly, ghostly, right?
It's oh,
like
yeah.
A film of a film, so it's like the ghost of the actual thing. I don't know. It just gives it, all of this just adds up to the vibe.
And I love the, speaking of ghostly, the narrator, played by the great Frank Gallup, who had been the announcer on the Milton Berle radio show, and then was the announcer, among other things, on Perry Como's TV show for many years. And he was great blowing out that candle and setting up the story.
And you can't underestimate the role, too. And they have, like, different... They're not all the same at all. They're tonally, they're not the same, but, like, the narrator, the host, the MC, and it goes back to, like, the Mercury Theater with, like, Orson Welles. Like, the person introducing it was... All of that was, like, important. And if you listen to, like, episodes of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, that narrator really comes out, that MC, that host, that intro person, that's the scene of what's going to happen, and then takes us out at the end. They always get, like, full billing, too, because they really were, like, your travel guide, I feel like. You had to trust them, even if, like, you didn't trust them, like, oh, we're going to be pals. You had to trust them that they were leading you to something worth your time. I mean, there was a real role for that in this particular age, because you didn't have a million channels. Mm. You just had, like, these people. So they became these confidence men, almost, where they had to get your trust. So yeah, it's like a little hokey because it's lights out, but it's lights out. So I mean, what do you really expect?
Let's move from there to a little musical interlude. This was fascinating. A recording from Stockholm, 1967. Pink Floyd. Somehow the microphone set up so all you heard were the instruments and not the vocals.
Yeah, it's that way throughout the entire set. I was thinking about Pink Floyd because they're a strange band, because a lot of their appeal is the kind of like wig out, trippy, extended instrumental in concert type of approach to music. And yet, none of these guys, for the most part, or at least at this point in the band, this would be September 1967, they're not like virtuoso players. Normally when bands do that, whether it's the Grateful Dead being an obvious example, or the Who to a certain degree, you have guys that can just like play incredibly or play incredibly with each other and improvise off of each other. Pink Floyd was not that way. It's not like Nick Mason was some amazing drummer. He's no like Keith Moon or anything like that. So you get this live recording from very early on in the band's career. So it was like a few months after Piper at the Gates of Dawn had come out. And like you said, the vocals don't record. So you're hearing this band really going for it, hard-charging band, unaware themselves, I'm sure, that the vocals aren't picking up in this recording. So, and again, it's kind of like the idea of the ghost, right? Because you'll hear the vocals sometimes, like in these gaps between the instruments. Like it's like someone way, way down the hall, off mic, in like the haunted house from this different room type of thing. And it really just lends more bite in some ways to just how hard these guys are playing. And I love that sound of a band that's not complacent and they're hungry for blood. I remember this quote once where Ian McCullough of Echo and the Bunnymen, he was talking about their first album. And he said, like nostalgically, he said, well, 2 pints and we would be flying back then. He almost sounded like he regretted it, that he wasn't that way anymore. It's like this proper adult now of like whatever 50 or whatever he was when he said that. Because those were the days of like the don't even cook my meat. I want the blood in it. This is sort of like the Pink Floyd sonic version of that.
Colin, do you find when you listen to live recordings that this is often the case, that a band perhaps plays some of its most inspired, maybe not its best, but its most hardworking music before they reach the pinnacle, before they become what they ultimately become?
Yeah, it does. It does work out that way. I mean, it's also going to depend on the length of the band's career. Like, for instance, the Rolling Stones, there's nothing worth listening to them live, almost. Maybe here and there from 1978. But there's almost nothing worth listening to live from them after 1973. So you really only have, like, if you count the BBC material, going back to, like, the mid-60s and then up through, like, Exile and Goat's Head Soup. But, like, you don't need to hear the Stones, like, really. I mean, there's the odd recording if you're that into them. And Dylan has had his different incarnations, so there's that. But yeah, Zeppelin is a lot different. It's like a live animal in 1970 than they are in 1980. In 1980, you're listening to them because you want to hear what they sounded like at the end. But like even a band like Def Leppard, I was listening to the show from Denver in 1988. It kind of shocks me. It's something that I never would have thought possible when I was like a teenager listening to them. Def Leppard was actually really good live when they were in their prime. But like listening to Def Leppard in their prime after Hysteria, you have that sort of motivation, the wind in the sails, Armageddon style, that you don't have if you listen to like Def Leppard live in, I don't know, 1995. So a lot of times, though, it's dictated by where they are in their career, what album they've just come off of, how long they've been in the studio, what they want to achieve in terms of the level of hunger. I mean, I think like when Bill Belichick got to New England, he was a different level of hungry in 2001 than he is now, like drafting you and me in the late rounds. Like there's just something about that when you have something to prove. And so when a band has something to prove, that's really when you want to get them. And like the Beatles, they were awesome live in like 63. By the time they get to 66, just a short time after, almost always they're just phoning it in, with rare exceptions.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. All right, let's talk about one of the most legendary moments in baseball history. 1953, a young Mickey Mantle playing against the Washington Senators at Griffith Stadium in D.C. hits what is still regarded as the longest home run of all time, according to Red Patterson, the PR guy of the Yankees, 565 feet.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to talk about this was I just think it illustrates the madness of our current world in a highly specific way, because this was a long time ago, and I am a member, more like a lurker, as they call them, of these various groups for my different interests, so like baseball history groups on Facebook. If you've been in any of those, you know that the same material is posted over and over again because no one has like an original thought or an original image, so it's always like Nolan Ryan beating up Robin Ventura. That's all the time. Every, like 7 times a day, there's a Pete Rose argument. Should he be in the Hall of Fame? Like, really? We're still doing this. And so I was wondering about what used to be called old timers and self-awareness. At what point do you stop knowing what you've become and you enter into that zone of just being that embittered person for whom everything was better in your day? And I cite this because look at baseball right now, where we have the home runs charted like to the inch, whatever it is, with the technology that exists. And these guys are, they're just massive, right? They're so much bigger than anyone else used to be. The bat speed is of a greater velocity. And the pitchers are throwing far, far, far harder than they were when, like, you were a blazer with your 91-mile-per-hour fastball and no one else in the league came close to that. So it's just physics. The harder you throw the ball, you make contact, the further the ball is going to go. What's the furthest home run you ever remember seeing in this age of, like, obsessively charting home run lengths? I don't recall any over 500 feet.
No, I don't either. I think, there have been a couple. I think maybe Aaron Judge hit one of them that was like 475, 480. But no, I don't remember anything over 500.
So it would seem that it's simply not possible, like the science of it, that you could hit a ball 565 feet if no one is hitting a ball 565 feet now. And I think Mantle sort of had a weird career because he only has the 4-100 RBI season, which is like shocking, right? I mean, Carlton Fisk had two. You wouldn't think that like Mantle only had two more than Fisk, but I think Mantle was actually underrated. And you can come pretty close to squeezing him, if we leave out pitchers, into the top 10 players of all time. Certainly top 12, because I've done that. But these guys, so I'm looking at the Facebooks like, well, allegedly 565 feet. Some guy immediately, what do you mean allegedly? What, WTF? Well, I mean, reality. So there's that.
Well, they also, they counted the roll, too, so that added a little bit to it.
Yeah, they counted the roll and the train it bounced up and landed on and like drove off with. Like, think about like the Mass Pike behind Fenway. Like, it doesn't look that far. No one's hit a ball into the Mass Pike. Not Jim Rice, not Manny Ramirez. I mean, it has to be a right-hand hitter, obviously. But no one's done that. So it just made me think, like, yes, here's a sports thing. But to these men, they're always men, do they not know that they've crossed over into their own twilight zone where they've left thinking in reality behind? Because these same guys, it's not just because it's Mickey Mantle. I find that they do it with, in my day, you would just lay down a bunt, and because of the shift, you could leg it into a triple. Like, really? I would like to see that. That would be something. I'm shocked by it. I'm not shocked in a way. I want to be shocked. I'm depressed, and I'm not shocked. But how can you, like, not know that? I want to sit down and be like, look, granddad, honestly, your age doesn't mean that you have to lose your mind. You still have it. You, like, can think through these other things. You understand what I'm saying? It just baffles me that no one even allows that maybe this didn't happen, and maybe there's science, and maybe there's reality. I don't get it, and I see it, like, all day when I look at these sites.
Yeah, and I don't understand the desire. I get looking back. I love nostalgia. But you can also appreciate the guys that are playing today, and it doesn't mean that if you love a Mike Trout or a Shohei Ohtani or an Aaron Judge, that doesn't mean Mickey Mantle's still not great, too. It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive.
Well, how about that red chair at Fenway, the Ted Williams
yeah.
poster?
Oh, yeah.
Hit the guy in the hat, and that was like 520 feet. How about just that it was really cool that Ted Williams hit a ball that everyone knew at the time went further than anyone else hit a baseball? And then later, when we can fix things, we can edit. I mean, it's like going back into a story, and it was a really great story. Awesome. Kicks ass. No one can touch it. Like a year later. And you see like four or five things that you can change. Maybe they're not huge things. It's a word here, it's a word there. One paragraph, you can break up into two paragraphs for better flow. You have the luxury of the new knowledge. So you do it. Different perspective. I'm here now, that was then, this is this moment. You have to do that in life. And it frightens me because it's just baseball. I get that. It's just this home run from decades ago. But this is also how people think. And it's not conducive to wellness. It's not conducive to dialogue. It's not conducive to growth, community, the exchange of ideas. And this is the baseball example, but if you look around, you see everyone, not just these old men, but almost everyone doing a version of the 565-foot home run. So microcosmic, but certainly like a maximalist impact.
Maybe they should just drink some lemon water, Colin.
Yeah, I'm into lemon water. And so like when I started getting sick the other day, you ever notice like when you get sick, like you can pinpoint it to like the half hour?
Oh, yes.
Does
oh,
it
yeah.
ever work?
Can tell you that exact moment when it turned. Yeah.
Yeah, like, so I'm like, I'm fine at the beginning of Last Man Standing. And then, like, when we get to the final scene, I'm like, something's not right. I'd walked whatever I did, like, 5 miles and ran 5,000 stairs and so did my thing. And I started getting sick. So what I start to do is, well, first I flip the Zoom and switch. And like,
well,
I'm
sure.
not going to be sick. I give myself a deadline. Even when I had the pneumonia, I gave myself a deadline of 2 weeks. I went in and I had to get my license renewed. So like the photo of my license from back then, 2016, I look like one defeated, sad sack, fatigued sea dog. But like, because it was just after my sickness. So I set the deadline and then I just start chugging things. I start drinking liquid. I'm going through the tea. I'm having like 20 vitamin C pills. But what I normally do all the time anyway, speaking of old men, I cut up some lemons and I put them into a water bottle from Gloucester. And so when I drink, this is just one of my water bottles, but when I drink from this one, I'm getting the benefits of the lemon. And part of the reason I'm doing that is because for many years, like 20, I would have my 30 units of alcohol a day.
Oof.
And attack my liver. So lemon is like the ultimate thing. So like the liver is great because it recovers
right
until the point where you take it too far and the liver's like, I'm done. So even though like I recovered, I still want to be kind to the liver. So I have the lemon, which the liver loves. It's like a catnip for the liver. And I have these milk thistle pills, like Eeyore style, which are also for my liver. But this is just low budget. This is as foody as the sea dog gets. Cut up some lemons, put them in your water bottle, and leave them soaked for days. That is one tasty, healthy, salubrious concoction.
And then if you need something warm, you go with what? Is it the hibiscus tea?
Yeah, well, the hibiscus tea I don't like. So
This
is all part of my routine. So hibiscus tea, peppermint tea, and I make like a lot of these things, huge batches actually right before I come on. That's for my blood pressure. That's for my heart health. So, yeah, the water is for the heart health, but hibiscus and peppermint tea, they supposedly help with things like blood pressure and, well, I mean, obviously the stairs and the not drinking. But it's silly. Like when I was a kid, I played hockey. And coaches would always say, when you stand there on your ass watching TV, squeeze a tennis ball and like itchy your hands, right?
Right, right.
Do you know what I'm saying, though? Because it would help your wrist shot.
Yep.
And it's just one of those things where you get a benefit without doing anything. You cut up this lemon and you put it in the water. Seriously, it changes the water. It makes it like 400% fat, but it makes it much more effective than the water already is. And you're not even doing anything. And it is just, I know you have to be a lemon person to do this, and a lot of people aren't, but it's just so damn zesty.
Health tips. Living tips from the Sea Dog Zulu Warrior here on Downtown. Colin, thank you as always, my friend. I trust by this time tomorrow, you'll have kicked whatever it is that's biting you and made it your own.
Yeah, unless I have a setback, and that is not part of the Zulu code.
No, not a chance of that. Thank you, Colin. Be well. See you soon.
All right, I'll see you.